This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
An interesting week all told for Manchester City as defeat against Wolves ended the 100% start to the new season and raised questions about how the team will cope in one upcoming big game without Rodri in the centre of the pitch. But then there was a perfectly good and professional display in Germany as Pep Guardiola's side eased past RB Leipzig in their Champions League group game. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon podcast, where no matter how well certain individuals played on Wednesday, all eyes are already starting to drift towards Sunday's trip to Arsenal. We'll preview that match later on in the show, but first we're going to focus on a few talking points surrounding the team's shape, management of games and personnel available. Plus there's some fine individual performances to discuss as well. Rico Lewis, we're looking in your direction. Also this week we've had the sad news that Francis Lee has died at the age of 79. We'll discuss the impact he had at Main Road as both a player and as chairman, as Manchester football historian and author Gary James pays tribute to a true club legend. I'm David Mooney. With me for this week's show, I've got from statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Hello.
And from Sporting News, Dom Farrell.
Hello.
Hello, hello. So, yeah, a bit of an interesting week, Adam.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. We seem to have that this season, even though we've been amazing and you've referred to 100% season, 100% start. There's been little mini ups and downs within that 100% start, if you know what I mean. So yeah, interesting one to get stuck into.
Have you coped putting that first entry of a defeat into your database for the Premier League season?
I've not actually done it yet, because if we win, it's the first thing I do, and I tweet about it saying the database has been updated, go and check it out. If we draw or lose, I kind of just do it a couple of days later, like in silence, and don't even announce that. Yeah. I've done it. So that's where I'm at the minute.
Good. You must be a bit annoyed as well, because was it not going to be City's best start in the league for like 100 years or something?
Oh, I had loads lined up. You should see my drafts folder. It's literally what could have been every week.
As soon as I clocked that was a possibility, Dom. I just knew no chance City were winning at Wolves.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, obviously Adam will have had all that stuff prepped, but yeah, it does always, like, from a journalist's point of view, it does feel like the kiss of death whenever you prepare things for sort of things that you think might happen. I mean, like, for example, the
what's your worst one? You must have some bad ones.
To be honest, I'm trying to think now. I don't think there's any that have been too absolutely howling, but I do remember, like, the Liverpool title run-ins that went to the last day. We basically had to have things done for if City win, if Liverpool win, and it was deemed as more likely, as it turned out was the case, that City would do it those times. So both of those times, I had a few bits and bobs, like, ready to go, and when it's 2-0 to Aston Villa, you're like, is this all my fault? You know, but it's one of those things.
Yeah, well, we'll get into the analysis now of both the Wolves and the Leipzig game. But first, for the 2023-24 season, the Blue Moon podcast is sponsored by Green King Sports, where football is more than a game. Green King Sports venues are showing every televised City fixture over the 23-24 season. So instead of turning to the internet for a dodgy stream, get your mates together and get down to your local Green King pub and get closer to the action. City travel to Arsenal this weekend. We'll preview that game later on in the show as well. If, like me, you won't be heading to the Emirates, why not watch it in the next best place, a Green King Sport pub? Green King Sport have just recently launched their Green King Sport Instagram page too, which will be the home to fan content, deals and competitions throughout the season. Drop them a follow. You won't just be the first to know about all of this. You'll also be helping out the Blue Moon podcast as well. I think, Dom, it's a really hard one to pitch this, because obviously there's talking points around both games for City this week, but it feels really difficult going into this podcast not focusing on Rico Lewis, given the performance that he put in on Wednesday night. He played a lot further forward. He wasn't in defence. He really didn't look out of place, did he?
Not at all. I mean, you said at the start, like, attention's already turning towards Arsenal, and that's, like, going to be the big focus of the week. I think at 7:45 last night, you'd have been hard-pressed to find anybody who was starting Rico Lewis at the Emirates Stadium in their Dream City 11.
He might now,
Is it hard not to pick him now? Yeah, he was brilliant. I saw one of those. I mean, when you get this for God, every play in every game, far be it from me to say people have too much time on their hands, but someone had clipped up a load of Lewis's, like, involvements in the game. I saw a video of that on Twitter earlier. And most times he receives the ball, it's like he gets it on the half turn or he changes the direction of the play. It's like it's properly like 360-degree football, which is so just completely perfect for a Guardiola team. And you sort of, I know there's been a lot of talk about the academy lately, and I know a lot of people have been seeing Cole Palmer start well at Chelsea, and it's a little bit mixed emotions for everyone. But obviously Foden is the standard bearer of that academy, but considering he was on the bench in like Guardiola's first season, a couple, you know, again in the Champions League, I think it was against Celtic. He's kind of a bit of a freak that he's just incredibly gifted, and it was going to happen for him regardless. I wonder if Lewis, who like was very little fanfare about even until he played friendlies at the start of last season, now like the whole this way of playing football, this culture around the club is there. This is as Guardiola was alluding to in an interview last night. It's not like he's, you know, he's not particularly tall. He's not massively physical, although he can look after himself. He's not overly quick, but he can just do everything to like a really, really high level of competence. And yeah, you wonder if this is, or you would hope from a City point of view, this is the start of loads and loads of players like this coming through, because it's he's every position he plays, he looks a complete natural. It was wonderful to watch him last night. It really was.
I mean, Adam, the other side of this as well is Lewis got the assist for Foden's opener. It's literally a goal made in the Champions League by City's academy.
I love that. You know my thoughts on the academy, and if anyone shows any semblance of being any good from the academy, I'm all over it and putting him on the highest pedestal possible. So yeah, certainly a goal made in Greater Manchester there on the German continent. So it's just perfect. There's a pride element. I went into work today and I work with a lot of Liverpool fans, and they're saying, oh, that Rico Lewis is great. And it's almost, there's almost a bit more pride than if they were telling me Erling Haaland's great, or, you know, so there's certainly that added element why we want him to do well. His age comes into it for me. The fact that he's putting these performances in at that age, he looks accomplished. There's still loads he can learn, but Dom alluded to the way he takes the ball on the turn, is that now just a product, a byproduct of being in the academy now?
A City thing, yeah.
Yeah, a City thing. The way Foden does it, now the way Lewis does it, and Pep always talks about Lewis being able to see the 360 degree of the game. And that's evident in the way he's receiving the balls, the way he's breaking lines, the way he's getting us up the pitch. He's playing further forward last night, and that's when he's getting assists to his game now as well. I love him in this further advanced position. My only concern is, was he able to play in that advanced position because Rodri was on the pitch? And then with Rodri definitely not going to be there against Arsenal, does that change the role he might be playing in that game if he plays at all, because we've not got that safety net? So that was the only thing. I didn't want to get too excited last night about this advanced role when I don't know whether it's because of the other pieces of the puzzle that were in place to allow that as well. And that's probably why I'm here as a guest, to kind of answer those questions rather than pose them. But
well, I was
going to
say,
my initial thought was,
if you're not going to answer that question, I'm certainly not going to try and answer that question. So, Dom, over to you.
No, I think it's a very good point. I think, you know, but on the other hand, so I was looking at this from the other point of view of when looking at the Wolves game and then who will be Rodri against Arsenal, and how, and I've been largely dead impressed with Mateo Kovacic since he joined City, up until the game at Molineux, which wasn't his best. But then you think about, so to reverse it from what Adam said, is Kovacic in that game playing as the holder had Nunez, who's quite direct, and Doku, and who else was playing? Alvarez, Foden. But if he plays there with Lewis, Bernardo, Grealish ahead of him, then maybe it's easier for him. So yeah, it's a...
But Bernardo is a piece of that puzzle as well, I've just thought. So there's a bit of control and security. So it's a difficult one, but Lewis deserves all the plaudits, and he deserves to be certainly in the reckoning, if not in the guaranteed starting 11.
Does it change for you, Adam, if because you look at the flanks against Molineux, and you know, you've got, as Dom says, you've got very attacking players there. If you play instead Bernardo and Grealish with Foden alongside Lewis in the middle, as you kind of did on Wednesday night. I know it's kind of an unchanged side from a game a couple of days ago, but it's a lot more controlling, a lot more secure. And I know Arsenal will leave more spaces than Wolves did.
Yeah, I think you've answered my question, and we got there together in a roundabout way. I'd feel more confident, even though I'm praising Lewis to the hill, and he's amazing, and we should not deflect away from that. I'm happier with him in the team if he's got a bit of protection, because he still does get battered. He doesn't complain about it. He's quite resolute, I think, because younger players have lost their head in those type of moments. So I think that should be singled out for a bit of praise as well, his mentality. But for a physical battle, I'd just like to see City having more control in a game that he's asked to do a bit of a different role than being left back or right back.
Yeah. Dom, just as a general point, given that he is 18, that he has grown up as a fullback, and you know he's now playing number 8 in the Champions League, like can you put that into context, just how good that is as an achievement for a player?
That's mad.
But particularly for him, because obviously he started playing that... You know, he was kind of the spark for the second half of last season. We all know how sort of phenomenally, historically that ended by him sort of nailing the fullback coming inside and what, you know, how to do all that. But then obviously John Stones did that from centre-back. He could do it with more physicality than Lewis. So then he didn't start many games towards the end of the season. Then the start of this season, it's all about Kyle Walker holding the width and bombing up and down the flank. And you think, oh well, God, where does Rico Lewis get in his team now? Because even though he's the other fullback in the senior squad,
yeah, it's in Gundogan's position. That's where he gets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's mad.
Just let him be Gundogan instead, and he did it really well. So, interesting though. I mean, I would be, you know, going back to sort of the talking about the control wingers or the attacking guys out there. I'd like to see him because you know he's already played several positions and looked good in them. I wonder if you could play Lewis as like the right back who holds width really high up, and he maybe does it a bit differently to Walker, that you maybe have someone a bit more attacking inside him. I think he could do that as well, because you know, as we saw last night on Foden's goal, his delivery into the box is good, and that's sometimes not a massive strength of Kyle Walker's. So I think provided that the guy, it's probably something you try in a game where Rodri's there and when John Stones is fully back up to speed.
Not at the Emirates, you mean?
yeah. Probably get the keen goal from the dugout leaves that particular club in the bag this weekend. But it's something I wouldn't mind seeing him try, you know? I think that could be interesting.
Yeah. Mm. Well, let's look a little bit more at the controlling of games, because I'm wondering if City have a little bit of a problem with the transitions at the moment, and it might come down to controlling players versus ball-carrying players. But this was what Guardiola had to say on it after the Leipzig game.
The time we allowed them to run the transitions, oh my God. In 2-3 passes, they're in front of Eddie.
3 goals conceded this week. All of them were in transition. 2 against Wolves, 1 against Leipzig. Is that a problem when City don't have that holding player?
It is a weird one, because that felt like the big thing more than anything else that was solved, like from about February onwards last year. They just suddenly stopped letting those goals in whatsoever. I'm sure there's an example I'm forgetting, but thinking back to last season, there was that equaliser Forest got that was... Well, it wasn't really transition, like Laporte sort of...
Laporte was transitioning somewhere, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Another dimension, maybe?
Yeah. Well, he was transitioning to Saudi Pro League, it turned out, what he was doing there. But goals of that ilk, I don't think they let another one of those in. And then they've let 3 in a week that are big counter-attack goals. Now, there's a couple of factors there. Like, obviously, for Wolves, certainly on that first goal, which was like a number of errors from City, but like Neto is rapid and really good in those situations. Obviously, it's pretty much Leipzig's calling card. You know, every time City have played him over the last 3 years, with them becoming the new Shakhtar Donetsk and all that, yeah. Guardiola has always banged on about how good they are at the counter-attack. And also, like, thinking back to when he was Bayern manager, like, reading the Marty Perenau's book about him there, that was when he properly got obsessed with counter-attacking teams, and you know, they do it really well in Germany. So they've played 2 teams that are quite adept at it. But yeah, that is, again, maybe not a worry for the weekend, because Arsenal are going to try and control sections of the game. But it's a bit like sort of an old problem coming back to haunt them. I do wonder if it's as simple as the reason they stopped it last season was how John Stones has been used. I mean, what Stones was doing on the ball in midfield caught everyone's eye. But I wonder if he was just great at just blocking things off on the halfway line as well. And I know they've done like a Kanji's dipped into midfield a bit, Gvardiol clearly has that in his locker, you know, but they've worked the back three, back four in a different way this year. And I wonder if that's part of it, along with the control dynamic players sort of balance you were talking about.
Yeah. The other side of this, Adam, is, okay, Rodri was on the pitch for the Leipzig goal, but he wasn't on the pitch for the two Wolves goals. Kovacic and Nunes instead. What did you think of that? Because I mean, if I'm being perfectly honest, I didn't think it was going that badly in the first half. They had the one, Wolves had the one moment and they scored from it, and it wasn't, they didn't even have a shot. It was like they crossed it and somebody else put it in for them. And then Guardiola goes, this isn't working, and he takes Nunes off for Bob at halftime. And I thought that was a very premature call on what was a system that maybe wasn't working, but wasn't a disaster.
Yeah, it almost wasn't working, but not that badly. Like, there's a few things to address there. First off, obviously the two goals we conceded to Wolves, it's the first time we've conceded two in a single game since January.
Good
so
stat.
Dom alluded to us fixing that problem, and it, almost the old, you know, the old patterns coming back to haunt us. And that's just so happened in the game that Rodri's not there. So, you know, for the first time...
Coincidence or not, do you think?
Well, so I wouldn't choose to... I did choose in my team that I put on Twitter beforehand, or X as it is now, that Nunes and Kovacic were going to be my Rodri in that kind of settled double pivot role, doing one man's job, both of them. So I was satisfied with it before the event. Then during it, I wasn't overly enamoured with it, but I certainly didn't think it was cause for hooking someone at half time. Now, I've got a few trains of thought on that as well, if I may. Has he hooked Nunes at half time because he was going to be hooking him on 55 minutes, and that's more embarrassing the way the Wolves fans were treating him? Does he even care about that? Or is he doing him a bit of service by hooking him in the dressing room and him not having to face that humiliation of being hooked off at 55? We'll never know. And I don't think really that Pep cares about those type of trivial, oh, the fans keep shouting nasty things at me, I'll put my arm around you kind of thing. But that's just
my... He encourages it more than anything else.
Exactly. So that was my initial thought. I certainly didn't think Oscar Bob was the right substitution to make, specifically for putting him in the middle of the park. If you're bringing Oscar Bob on, you're putting him either further in the pockets near the striker or out wide, because that's how he's been used sparingly in his fleeting appearances up to this point.
Yeah.
So it would be revisionary of me to say, oh yeah, Nunes and Kovacic didn't work in the middle, because that was what I was clamouring for before the game.
Well, we've been revisionary. Can I ask you both a question?
You can try, whether I'll answer it or not.
Right, so bearing in mind what we talked about from last night and sort of players playing in the pockets and things like that, do City win that game at Wolves if Rico Lewis comes on for Nunes instead of Bob?
Wow. It's a good question, because as Adam said, I expected Bob to play a little bit wider or a little bit further forward, with the idea of getting Foden more on the ball in the centre. And he just seemed to come on and take the exact role that Nunes was playing. And Guardiola said afterwards it was all about the small spaces, and that Bob is good in the small spaces. So I take that point. But if Lewis is there instead, you know, maybe they do win the game, Adam.
Yeah, if it's Leipzig Lewis, yeah, I'll take it all day long.
Yeah,
Leipzig Lewis sounds like a brilliant stage name or something.
Is it not like a 1940s cartoon?
something like that.
Definitely, like a detective cartoon. Leipzig Lewis.
Yeah, but it's a dog. It's not it's a detective dog, isn't it?
100% a dog. 100% detective dog
that plays by its own rules.
Yeah,
in the pockets.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I'll get that back on track then. Dom, the other side of this, the Wolves game in particular, the initial setup maybe not working too well. And I kind of imagined it was a bit like, you know, going back to cartoons, you know, when you see a cartoon character kind of like plug a leak and then another leak spouts out somewhere else, and they plug that, and then another one comes out, and then they've got to use another part of the body, and then they're using kind of like two arms, a foot, like the forehead, like just everything,
and a 20-year-old Norwegian.
Yeah. And I just kind of got the impression that every time City tried to fix something with their setup and their system, something else was going wrong as a knock-on effect. And I wonder if it's just simply a case of, you know what, it's absolutely fine. City will be fine without Rodri for most of the games that they play. But the truth is, they're not all right without Rodri, without Stones, without Bernardo, without De Bruyne, all at the same time.
Yeah, and say with the exception of De Bruyne, they're all like you guys who will take the sting out and knock 15, 20 passes together to just sort of get things under control again. So yeah, I think that definitely was a point. If you're doing cartoon things, though, we're probably going to talk about Jeremy Doku's celebration last night and what cartoon that was, because that was a bit strange, wasn't it?
That's like a gritty. Yeah, the kids call that the gritty.
Is it? Right.
Whatever that is, I don't know.
Yeah, we're all old guys. We can't do this. We don't know what it is. I don't know what it is either.
Funnily enough, there is sounding all that goal celebration. So I'd sort of mocked this Doku celebration. And my dad messages me going, at least it's not another knee slide, which I think is a brilliant, it's such a good modern football thing to get across about. They're all just doing bloody knee slides nowadays. So that
game's cool. Gone.
But surely, no, hang on, I'm sorry, your dad's wrong here. Because like, surely game's gone is all the bloody dancing that players do when they celebrate. Surely yeah, it should be, a solid goal celebration is, look at that, ran towards the corner flag, Uwe Rosland at knee slide. There we go. Yeah.
Maybe my dad knows what a gritty is, so...
Yeah, he's on that grind.
Yeah, fair play.
Yeah. At the same time, Dom, the Leipzig game, City were much more in control, and ultimately they came down to the selection. They had a lot fewer ball carriers in there. They had players who were going to control it. The flip side of that coin, and like, this coin has flipped so many times here now... City's performance really stepped up when Doku and Alvarez came on. Doku, ball carrier, Alvarez, risk taker. Like, it just like, make it make sense, please.
rolling the 10-sided dice there. I think it is fairly simple that part of the reason that, because there's been a few City games in Europe like this, the one that always springs to mind is when they won at the Bernabeu just before COVID. When Guardiola basically had Jesus as sort of a left wing back and didn't pick a striker, it was like a sort of the no striker formation. And then he switched back to that was really good. They controlled the game 1-0 down. He then switches back to a 4-3-3 with Sterling on. They scored two goals. It's like, oh, well, if he just played normally at the start, then fine. But obviously, part of the reason Madrid were ragged at the end was they'd been passed around the pitch for 70 minutes in the original formation.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true. Like, you know, City had 70%, give or take, possession last night. If you've been chasing the football around for 70 minutes, the last thing you want to see is Jeremy Doku coming up and Julian Alvarez in this form. So it's like, again, I know we're going to talk about squad depth later, but one thing about the side that was out last night is there was genuine options to change it off the bench. And you contrast that with when they were chasing the game at West Ham, and sort of Chuck Nunez on for a debut to kind of see what happens, and it worked well and he played well. I thought that looked really good. And it's, yeah, the natural thing to do in that situation is to clamour for, you know, Doku and Alvarez have both got a start at the weekend. But if the game's in the balance with 20 minutes left, you kind of like the same option again, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Let's talk specifically about Alvarez, Adam, because at the moment, I mean, I haven't got the stats. I expect you probably have them at the drop of a hat, but this is where you prove me wrong. He seems good for a goal or assist pretty much every game this season. How has that happened? Because midway through last season, I remember thinking, like, I know he's a World Cup winner. I know he's been playing really well. I just kind of want to see a bit more from him. Then all of a sudden, blink, and like, he's doing this every week.
Yeah, I think it's the fact that De Bruyne is out of the side and that he's found a settled role that isn't competing with Haaland. So I put it down to his last season. He obviously was in and around the team with Haaland, but people were expecting him to do a striker's role. Whereas now with De Bruyne injured, he's had to almost do that kind of number 10 or just in the pocket behind the striker role. And that's why I think we're seeing the best of him now, because he's having a prolonged run in the team, be it from the bench or starting, and then having that impact regardless of whether he starts or comes on. So I think that's a major part of why he's able to flourish, because it's a prolonged in that role, in that a prolonged period in that role, rather than trying to kind of compete with what Haaland was trying to do at the top end of the pitch, which I feel like he was doing last season.
Yeah, well, here's a question, Dom, that may or may not get me cancelled. We'll find out when this goes out. His development, has it come a little bit at the expense of Erling Haaland, if I may say that?
I don't think so. I think Haaland's not playing particularly well, and that's allowed when you're 23 and, you know, still early in your career at a club. You know, the guy that scored 50 odd goals is still finding his feet. but no, I think, and so you look at like the game against Fulham, which is that weird like 5-1 win where they didn't play particularly well. You know, Haaland and Alvarez links up for those goals. I think, no, I'm not sure about that. I think probably more of an issue for Haaland this year.
It's like he keeps missing big chances.
That, there is that. But I wonder if part of that is, and this is purely out of my own head. I've not discussed this with anybody who knows better than me. But
oh, this is good. This could be crazy.
Yeah. Right. So Haaland linked up like instantly really well with De Bruyne, and like De Bruyne got so many assists from last year.
Yeah.
De Bruyne as a provider is like, he'll take a touch and he looks for the ball straight away. While there's like creative players in there now, like guys like Foden are playing really well. Even Doku as well. They're fellas who like to take 3, 4, 5 touches, shimmy a bit, move a defender about, and then slip maybe a shorter pass than De Bruyne would. And part of me thinks, like particularly I thought in the Newcastle game when Haaland missed several chances, most of them were laid on by Foden. I think there's a thing where he gets the rhythm of how De Bruyne sets him up. And I think it's a bit clunky at times with whether it's with Foden, with Doku, with Grealish. And Alvarez maybe sometimes, but although Alvarez is probably the most direct, even without De Bruyne's range of passing, I mean, who has got that? But yeah, I think that's more of where Haaland's problems. He still scored 9 goals so far, for crying out loud. But his relative problems, I think that's where they are, rather than anything directly to do with Alvarez.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about selections, because as Guardiola's team selections continue to be difficult because of injuries and suspensions, a lot of fans are questioning the club's decision not to bring in more players last summer. Guardiola's been talking about that and the pressures that it puts on his squad this week. Back in pre-season, Rodri was talking about his workload.
I think I have to have a talk with the club and with the coach, because playing 57, 59 games, I think it's not healthy. You can do it one season, but 2 or 3 in a row could be even worse for the team in the sense that the physicality you can drop.
Last season for both City and Spain, he played a total of 68 matches. This season, he started every game up until his suspension in this last week and a bit.
With my surround, with the people we already speak, that it cannot be like this. But as in the other hand, last year I have the feeling that we were fighting for everything, so I have to push until the body until the limit. That's why sometimes I feel like this at the end of the season, but also the seasons are like this. They're even longer every year, but we have to adapt.
Last week, the former City captain and current Burnley manager Vincent Kompany said the number of games a player can play should be capped. Guardiola was asked about player welfare too.
I would say that every idea that you reduce a little bit the amount of games for the players especially would be nice, but it's not going to be changed. There is only one solution to change something, but maybe all the players think about that, all the money think about that, is the players decide for themselves. The organisation said stop.
He thinks the only way the schedule will get any easier is if the players take matters into their own hands.
This business, the show must go on. Without Pep, must keep going. But without the players, the show will not go on. That's for sure. So it depends on them. They decide if they accept, because it's a big business, we have a big salaries and everyone. Like the president of UEFA said to Jurgen and to me, don't complain, because you win a lot of money. It's okay. So what can I say?
Guardiola also thinks football could learn from other sports when it comes to rest.
When it's a break, it has to be a proper break. Always I put example for NBA. NBA played 18 games in, I don't know, a few months. But after have 4 months off or 3 months off, you don't play the finals and you can't regenerate it. You know, the managers and everything, new ideas. And after full, the problem is he is full and after 3 weeks off.
City have been regulars in the Champions League for over a decade now, and their schedule has often been packed with midweek games as a result. There were a couple of seasons during the COVID-19 pandemic where, had City not been knocked out of one of the cup competitions, there would literally have been no room in the calendar for all the games they needed to play. Guardiola gave one example of how the club doesn't know what effect the lack of rest will have on players.
Jeremy Doku is not used to play every three games a week. In Rennes didn't happen. He's not used to. And I don't know how he's going to react every 3 days. Today have the players like playing the positions, they are stable, like Ruben, for example, like, I don't know, Kyle or Rodri. And when you have this type of players, it's, wow, it's heaven, because that helps us to be less players in the squad.
And that right there is the balancing act that Guardiola is doing. We all know he likes a small squad, but why? Especially when there's more games than ever. The Athletic's Sam Lee asked him.
Is one thing you could do in future just to have a bigger squad? Because I know you like to have a smaller squad, so is there no point there's a benefit to having more players?
The people say you have 90, 80, 90 players, and after you have 1 year, six injuries. You should feel longer squad. But what happened after that when you don't have injuries in one season? You have 25 players. How I can handle manage, play just 11, 14 players and play during a long, long time?
Guardiola does acknowledge, though, that there are downsides.
I prefer that situation. It's a risk, it's okay. That's why that when you recruitment, you have to be, okay, this player can play in three or four positions, Bernardo can play in 2-3, Phil can play in 2-3-4 positions, Julian as well can play in different positions. The people say, I want two players for each position. I'm not agree with that. I'm not agree. To be effective, you have to be regularly start 11 and make two or three substitutes. When you make a rotation 6 or 7 every week, it doesn't work well.
After injuries at various points of this season too, Kevin De Bruyne, John Stones, Bernardo Silva, Phil Foden, Jack Grealish and Mateo Kovacic, on top of a suspension to Rodri, it could be said that the chickens have come home to roost. Some may suggest that the decision not to spend more money in the transfer market to bolster the squad's numbers was foolish, especially when the club could afford to do it. But Guardiola would rather take the chance with a small, tight-knit squad to maintain the balance, harmony and rhythm week by week. It's a risk he's willing to take, and it's been successful over his time at the club. It's just unfortunate that, right now, it's left City not having many options over the start of this season.
I'm Carlo Nash, you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
That was a look at what Guardiola's been saying about having a small squad. Perhaps City got lucky with basically no injuries last season, Adam. It kind of feels like it's balancing out this season because they haven't really caught a break yet, have they?
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the key things that allowed us to maintain our momentum last year. Certainly the injuries. We were actually praising the medical staff and the way they were having the players in the river and being able to go every three games. And that certainly got us over the line towards the end of last season. And then this season, like that, what I said earlier, there's like stop starts within each kind of game within the season. We had 100% start, it was stuttered a little bit, but there's also been stuttering in them. We've not had John Stones available, we've not had Bernardo available, Rodri is the suspension, but just because he's suspended, it doesn't mean that we're not going to get an injury to Rodri and then we're in this position again. So we are now more susceptible to injuries because of the smaller squad, but it's annoying that is by design, and I totally understand why Pep wants his smaller squad. He's detailed there why he does it, but I think it's we used up all our luck last year, and it seems to we've already spent it already this time.
Luck doesn't work like that, though, does it? Yeah, you're not assigned an amount of luck at birth, and then you just kind of use it as you go along, do you?
No, you've got to say it evens itself out, and that's the only law we're allowed to apply to football, that it evens itself out.
I'd like to know the data on that, whether luck actually in life, whether it evens itself out. Like Unlucky Alf from The Fast Show, for instance. Like he would, as a character, that's built on the idea that luck does not even out.
So I'll tell you what.
It's juicy.
Hell of a week to be talking about evens itself out over the course of the season, isn't it? To anyone who's listening on Merseyside.
Yeah, we'll be coming to that a bit later on as it happens. Dom, do you take Guardiola's point? Small squad, easy to keep happy, but you just kind of accept the risk. And this season, yeah, we've accepted the risk and we've fallen foul of it a bit.
Yeah, I do. And it's like, it's kind of how he's always operated as well. I thought the squad was too small last season and they won a treble, so like, you can't really say, yeah. Could have done with a left back though, mate. And I think it's probably a one or two too small now. But when it looked really small was the Newcastle League Cup game, when you're thinking, this is absolutely when Palmer and McAtee play. But
sold you can't, them. Well, you can't, sold, yeah. sold one, loaned one, yeah.
Yeah, but you can't just keep them round to play a tough League Cup game that, you know, if Cole Palmer and James McAtee stayed and had played that night, as we saw with their performance against PSG, Newcastle, good team. Every chance Newcastle win anyway. And then it's like, all right, see you in the third round of the FA Cup. Do you know, so it's like, you can't, I think Guardiola alluded to this before Newcastle as well, where the squad's got really thin is where they've sold all the really good academy products and the next guys coming up are like a generation below and they need to get ready and he's not in the habit of just dishing out appearances. So I get that. And that's probably a separate conversation to have about how good the pathway is for the kids who are really good at 19 and 20 and aren't Rico Lewis, who's still only 18, for crying out loud. I think the squad's probably on the small side, but he likes that. The number of injuries is what's really brought into focus. And not only that, like we said previously, it's injuries to like the same sort of player as well, which results in the kind of hodgepodge team you end up throwing out against Wolves.
Yeah. I don't like dedicating time to the officials, but I do want to give some time on this week's show to the massive officiating blunder that took place over the weekend. I am, of course, talking about the fact that Hwang wasn't shown a second yellow card in that Wolves game. As badly as City played, Adam, a red card does change the game, doesn't it? He can't score the winner, but on top of that, it changes how Wolves set up and how they defend. And we can't sit here and say, oh, that's the reason why City lost, because they were still not up to speed. But it's one of those moments in a game where that changes and you don't know how the rest of that game goes.
Yeah. And the timing of it as well, just before half time as well. The whole team talk changes at half time. I know that's another cliche we can throw in there. But I just don't know. Well, I think I do know why it's not been given, and that's because it's a striker who hasn't got a reputation of being a tough tackler. If that's someone else who's known to be aggressive on the ball and dives in like that on a yellow, they're going off the pitch. There's no two ways about it. This isn't blue glasses thinking, which we're always hard done by. He dived in on Kyle Walker after the ball's gone on a yellow card. What more do you need to do to receive a second yellow? You've started me off again now.
Sorry. deep breaths, mate, deep breaths.
Yeah, exactly. We're over it now. We move on. But yeah, so it was the biggest howler of the weekend, you're right.
Yeah.
Also, he basically sent himself off. I mean, I know Hwang should probably never take up poker, because you see him, when he was on the floor after it, he like smacked the ground with both hands. It's like sort of like when a batsman walks in cricket. It's like he was like, oh, he'd decided he was getting sent off and then was delighted to see the ref forgot, slash bottled it or whatever we're saying.
Do you remember? Yeah. This is a blast from the past. But I was in the away end for this game. City drew 1-1 at Tranmere when they were coming back up to the Premier League, and Kevin Ort got sent off for basically denying a goal scoring opportunity.
I was there too, David.
Yeah, he just rugby tackled the Tranmere forward in the 90th minute and was like, "Nicky Weaver might save the penalty, and we might still win the game." I still remember him walking off because he rugby tackled him and then didn't even look at the referee after the whistle had gone. He just walked straight to the tunnel, which wasn't even like past the referee. It was just in the corner of the ground, like away from it. Like, never once changed the look of his direction. He like basically accepted, like he knew he was walking for that challenge.
Yeah.
And like, I must admit, I do like it when a player goes, yeah, you know what? I'm off. Yeah. I did it. I'm not going to complain about it. I did it.
As I recall, that game at Tranmere, it totally threw the ref as well, and he didn't get the red card out for ages. he was thinking he was going to have to go and talk, give all like a talking to.
Yeah, the admin.
And then he saw him like halfway towards the Wirral Tunnel, and he's like, "What's going on?" But also, I might be wrong. I think the fella who took down was Wayne Allison, who, if you remember, was an absolute unit. So fair play to Kevin Orlop.
He's done well,
took down like a massive centre-forward,
I want to finish this part of the show with a little bit of a cheeky look at this, because this is Jurgen Klopp this week.
I can say immediately, even probably some people don't want me that to say, but not as the manager of Liverpool so much, more as a football person, I think the outcome should be a replay.
That was Jurgen Klopp there speaking through a small section of his 5 minutes in an answer to a question about something that he insists he's definitely not angry about. Dom, Adam, if you are going to look at this from a City point of view, the obvious question now is which games does City need replaying because of absolute refereeing injustices? Adam, anything off the top of your head to start
I've got three to hit you with. So okay. Either, yeah, not that I'm bitter. Yeah, the Liverpool game, Champions League, where Sane gets a goal chalked off for absolutely no comprehensible reason.
Hang on. Are we going in with the second leg to start with, bearing in mind two of Liverpool's goals in the first leg were offside? City had a perfectly good goal disallowed and the penalty turned down when it was nailed on.
I'm grouping that one as one. One tie, yeah. However you want to look at that. The second one, Liverpool again, where Milner should have been sent off about 16 times for various assaults on Bernardo Silva and Phil Foden in a tie at Anfield in the Premier League. And my last one before I hand over to Dom is the Old Trafford derby last year with the Rashford-Fernandez offside. I'm still not over it and I never will be. Please replay that, please.
Yeah, Dom?
While we're in this period now of releasing audio, really, really keen to hear that Rashford one. Because I mean, it'd probably be pretty funny now. I'll go further back. A year after that Tranmere game you were on about. The game against Middlesbrough in the year City got relegated with Joe Royal. Danny Teato got the ball in his own half, ran 40 yards, drilled the shot into the bottom
great
corner.
Goal.
The goal was disallowed for offside.
I still remember his Match of the Day interview where he basically looks, I can't remember who the commentator was, but he looks him dead in the eye and just says, you know, how can he flag that for offside? I'm the one who's picked up the ball in my own half and run the length of the pitch and not had any intention of passing it. And I was like, you know what, mate, you're right. You had no intention of passing that, and at least you've owned it, but you've scored as well, and it's been chalked off.
Yeah, so it's like, because I thought of that game and I looked at the table from that season, so City finished in the relegation zone, but they were 8 points behind Middlesbrough, who had like a bit of a late season kick. Now, if that's a City win rather than City draw in the February, the caveat is if City replay a game against Middlesbrough, even now with the teams they both have now,
they
City
obviously lose. Yeah,
probably find a way not to win because the record against Middlesbrough is hilariously bad.
Yeah. That was the game before or around the game where they lost at Main Road when they had a perfectly good goal disallowed against Spurs as well, wasn't it, Dom?
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine Twitter was around then? It'd just be like, well, it's clearly corruption, isn't it? Alex Ferguson's paying all the refs off is what I imagine City Twitter would have said. Yeah. Fun times.
Yeah, still not forgiven Sergei Rabrov. Right, well, let's move on. And this week we had the very sad news that the former City player and chairman Francis Lee has died at the age of 79. An important part of City's successful team in the late 1960s and an influential figure off the pitch in the 1990s, he goes down as a true Manchester City legend. I've been speaking to historian and author Gary James about the legacy that Lee leaves behind.
It's really sad news, isn't it? What is it? A legend, absolute legendary player, legendary England player as well. You know, he was one of those, everyone will talk about Beldy Summerby, but he was part of that brilliant City team that won all those trophies in the late 60s, start of the 70s, and was absolutely idolised. So for anyone who's not old enough to sort of know, if you think about the way players, even, you know, like Aguero have been idolised in recent years and so on, that's the level we're talking about. You know, it's right at the top. It's not that he's just a name who happened to be in that squad. He was absolutely one of the driving forces behind that team and a brilliant England forward as well. And then, of course, he was City chairman as well, which adds to the general story. But no, he was one of the biggest names in football. And for years, you know, whenever I'm like on holiday in Europe somewhere, I'll quite often go to a bookshop and look at football books that are, you know, like history of football type books, but in the local language, you know, whether it's France, Germany, or Italy, wherever it may be. And Francis is late for years, when I used to go and look in the index, they'd have, as far as Manchester City players were concerned, they'd perhaps have maybe something on Bert Trautman and something on Francis Lee and something on maybe Billy Meredith. And that would be it. Seriously, not even Colin Bell, you know. So internationally, Francis Lee was up there and was known as this brilliant, brilliant attacking player.
Yeah. What was he to that 68
team as well. The fact that I mean, obviously he went on to win pretty much everything at City. What did he bring to that team?
Well, I suppose the first thing is he brought a more of an attack-minded approach. Mike Summerby was actually the centre forward that season for virtually every game, and so when Francis Lee arrived, it was October. I mean, it's 56 years ago this week he arrived, and Joe Mercer described him as the final piece in that title jigsaw, if you like. And none of us are going to argue with City's greatest manager prior to Pep Guardiola, are we? You know, and he was that. He was that. It sort of transformed City, but he. You know, Neil Young scored loads of goals, and Mike Summerby was a brilliant centre forward for City that year, and eventually winger. Colin Bell was incredible, and you know, you could go through every member of that team. Superb, superb players. But Francis Lee just gave that little bit extra. A little bit like we have with Haaland in some ways, in that we know City was a brilliant team. In the last few years, City have been a brilliant team. When Haaland comes along, and it's suddenly we're at a different level again. And that's what happened with Francis Lee, and he was always a winner. He was always somebody who you felt if he was on your side, if he was with you, he would find success somehow, right? Whether that's in business, whether that's in football or whatever, horse racing, whatever he turned his hand to. And before City, he'd had enough of Bolton, and he basically went on strike. And I think this also shows you that with Francis Lee, if he didn't want to do something, if he wasn't happy, then he'd stop at the point when it's just going wrong. And when I interviewed him a few years back, I asked him about when he arrived at City, and he said he'd started up his business, and he was ahead of his time with his business. He was basically collecting newspapers and doing recycling, and that's how it developed into his toilet roll industry and all the rest of it. And he said he was out on his van collecting newspapers at a time when normal footballers would have been sort of training that, but he'd gone on strike with Bolton, and he said he got back or something, and there's a message, and it was Joe Mercer, right? And so he ended up phoning Joe Mercer up, and Joe had said, "Where have you been today?" And he said, "I've been on the golf course," or something like that, because if he'd have said, "I've been collecting newspapers," he'd have thought, "What the hell's going on here?" But yeah, I mean, he was to City at that time. We all talk about Bellies and Summerby, and we sort of perhaps overdo that to some extent because it was all about that entire team. But Francis Lee was a major contribution. He was a major difference between City and those other teams who didn't have Francis Lee or Colin Bell or Mike Summerby, you know?
Yeah, he was a big character as well, wasn't he? Because obviously the nickname was Lee One Pen, and there was the whole stories around, you know, let's call it going down easily in the box. yeah. But he knew a diver when he could see. I remember there's a video of him diving in the Manchester derby when he's conceded a foul, and he thinks that it's not a foul.
Well, yeah, I mean, that there's a great one. He actually accuses George Best of diving, and he does this belly flop over and over again, and the crowd get carried away, and it's great. It's funny, actually, because he did have that reputation, and I did an analysis on the season when he got all those penalties, you know, record-breaking penalty season, because people will say, Lee one pen, or Lee one pen, or, you know, it alternates, sometimes it's one pen, sometimes it's one pen. That season, I think it was Rodney Marsh who got more penalties.
Just Lee took them.
Lee took them, and he took them well. You know, he just blasted the ball, and the goalkeepers would jump out of the way, you know. But I did ask him, I did a cheeky thing one day, and I said to him, I was writing a thing for the Manchester Derby programme a few years back, and I was sat in his house, and he'd been having a glass of wine, and he was talking a bit more freely than perhaps he would do, and I just thought, I'm going to ask him about penalties, and I said to him, did you ever dive? And he went, no, and he paused, and he said, well, there was a minute. He did tell me about something. I'm not going to repeat it. But he told me about one incident. Right? And then he said to me, you bugger, you've got that on tape. And I went, yeah, I won't use it. And I'm not going to use it. Right? But the thing about it was, I think he knew, like most great footballers know, when somebody's going to have a go at you and what's going to happen. But more often than not, it was Francis Lee taking them, not diving, if you like, or not getting the foul. And so, yeah, it's just one of those things, isn't it?
Yeah. When it comes to City goal scorers, I mean, obviously the younger fans now will look at Haaland, will look at Aguero, those sorts of players. And then kind of my generation thinks back to Gota and to Dickhoff and those sorts of players as well. Where does Lee stand for that generation?
Well, you know, he scored, what, 30-odd goals one season, right? No, Gota was the only one who came close after that. And in terms of numbers beat it, you'd have to look back to see what competitions it was in, what level it was at, and do fair comparisons. But that's what we're talking about. So until recent years, until Gota and then until recent years, there's nobody to compare. We're blessed at the moment. But I think what I would say is if you're a young fan who's trying to think about how significant this is that Francis Lee's passed away, think of your hero today, whoever that may be, and then think of the day when they're no longer here. And there are people of my generation and above who were young children when Francis Lee was scoring goals for City, or towards the end of his career at City, or whatever it may be, and he was their hero. And it's difficult. You know, Francis Lee actually signed for City the day after I was born, so I can't say I saw him at his peak, right? But I do remember, my dad used to take me as a young child, and I do remember, and was certainly there the day he scored for Derby County against City, but I remember him playing for City.
That's look at his face.
Look at his face. I was sat in the Platt Lane stand that day, and the goal went in. And obviously we've seen it on Match of the Day since, and the you know, look at his face commentary comes from that, Barry Davis. But when the goal went in, there were people who jumped up near me because Francis Lee had scored. And then I'm sat there as a, what was there been? I was only about six or seven or something like that. And I'm like thinking, he's wearing a white shirt. He's not playing for City anymore, right? And other people, suddenly the realisation dawns, oh, it's Francis Lee, he scored against us. And he celebrated. And there's all that rubbish that people say about, oh, you should never celebrate if you go back to a club. Of course you should celebrate. I know it's different if the team you're playing is going to get relegated or something. I remember Paul Power scoring for Everton against City when City looked like we're going to get relegated, and eventually did get relegated, and he didn't celebrate. And I get that. I understand that. But when you're challenging for a title, as Derby County were, and you score a goal against the team that's just sort of sold you.
A good goal as well.
A brilliant goal. And of course you should celebrate, and of course you should look at his face, you know, and you should, and I don't begrudge that. And I think what that proves is Francis Lee was a winner. Sentiment didn't come into it. He was going to do his best for that team that he was playing for, and for many, many years he was doing that for City. And I just, it's really difficult getting over what a loss this is, but as a footballer he was just incredible. And he played in the 1970 World Cup. He should have played for England a lot longer. Alfie Ramsey did not pick him for a famous game against Poland, which you can look in this, England didn't go to World Cup because of his game, and Brian Clough called the Polish goalkeeper a clown, but he was brilliant, right? Saved everything. And Francis Lee did not play in that game, and he told me that he phoned Alfie Ramsey up and said, if there's one player who should be playing against Poland, it's me, because I've played against Gornik, I've played against Polish teams, get me in that squad. And he didn't put him in that team. And Francis Lee was convinced he would have scored. And I believe him. I think he would have done. I think he would have made that difference. And again, people say, oh, that's arrogance or whatever, but it's not. It's a winner's mentality. And that's what Francis Lee had.
You mentioned Gornik. Obviously, he scored in the final, scored a penalty, quite fittingly. He was there for the big moments, wasn't he? Like, you could rely on him in the big moments.
Yeah, he could. And that was a foul on Neil Young, and he took the penalty and he scored. And maybe Neil Young would have scored, who knows? But as we know now with City, it's not always easy to score a penalty. but Francis Lee seemed to get right time and time again. He was there for big moments. One of his greatest City games was the 1970 League Cup final. He didn't score. You know, Pardo and Doyle scored. Unlikely in a sense, Pardo and Doyle were both scoring, but Pardo and Doyle scored, Francis Lee didn't, but many people said that was his sort of greatest club performance, certainly up until that point, and then that is supposed to be the deciding factor in what took him to the World Cup in 1970. And I think, and it goes for Colin Bell this as well, and Mike Summerby. Bell Lee Summerby and Alan Oakes, who was in this sort of England reckoning, they were unlucky that England had won the World Cup in 66. And that sounds a silly thing to say, I know, but England winning the World Cup in 66, how do you change that team?
It cements the team, doesn't
it? Yeah, and Bell Lee and Summerby, all their peak came just after 66. You know, so maybe not the peak, but their rise to prominence came just after 66. So it was difficult for them to unseat the existing players. You know, how was Colin Bell going to replace Bobby Charlton, for example? You know, and same with Francis Lee. How would we do this? But Francis Lee managed to get into that England team, and he delivered, and he should have been in that England team for longer. But so many great moments. And you know, he left City. I'm going on here, but when he left City, he sort of had a bit of enough of City, and City didn't quite value him in the way that they should have done at that point, to be fair. He perhaps, again, City perhaps should have kept him longer. But anyway, he moved on. Things were changing. He moved on. And he went to Derby, and what did he do? Win the league. You know? And then he actually retired. I can't remember the exact age he was, but he retired at a fairly young age for a footballer, because his business was taken off and he wanted to spend more time doing his business, because that's how his mind worked. And even going to Derby, the reason he went to Derby, he could have possibly gone to, on the face of it, bigger clubs elsewhere, but Derby was within easy travelling time from his home and his business. So go to Derby. And he helped him win the league, you know. Great.
Yeah, you mentioned his business. You mentioned briefly earlier on that he did come back as City chairman. In the end, his tenure as chairman wasn't successful, and it had its problems. But he did offer at the start, in the mid 90s, when City were all over the place, off the pitch and on the pitch at times, he offered hope to fans.
Absolutely. And maybe you can compare this to sort of United, and you look at the way things are, or Everton, you look at the way things have gone over recent years. You know, City, when Francis Lee left City, City were a major power, right? Title challengers, a team that was used to playing in Europe, winning European trophies. At the time he left City, United were in the second division, City were Manchester's number one team, definitely. Peter Swales was chairman when Francis Lee left, and that might be part of the reason why Francis Lee felt undervalued, maybe. Peter Swales took that club and devalued it year on year on year. Yes, with some high points, 76 League Cup final. We can talk about some great moments, missing the title by a point or whatever, but the club was downgraded, right? Relegated twice in the 80s in a desperate state. For years, most fans had wanted Francis Lee to show interest in buying the club, because they knew he was a success as a businessman and so on. So eventually, when the opportunity came, there was a really long, bitter campaign, and it's not worth going into all the logistics of that and who's right and who's wrong. But Francis Lee was successful, but then he made three big mistakes, I suppose. One, he sacked Brian Orton when perhaps he shouldn't have done Brian Orton, perhaps should have been given another year, maybe. Right? He appointed Alan Ball, that was his other big mistake. Alan Ball was not the man to take City forward, but even then, he tried to get Franz Beckenbauer. Everyone wanted Franz Beckenbauer. He tried to get George Graham. Everybody wanted George Graham. He got Alan Ball. Nobody wanted Alan Ball, right? And the other big mistake was he kept on the board some of those people who were very much Swales supporters, and then they switched sides when they saw how things were going to go. And some of these people had been responsible for Malcolm Allison coming back, not Peter Swales, some of the other directors, right? So these people had played their part in keeping Swales in power and also downgrading City, and Francis Lee should have perhaps got rid of them. It would be like taxing Shinawatra staying on the board of directors when Caldoun's trying to take City forward. It can't work, it just can't. And unfortunately, that's happened. Now, Francis Lee definitely made mistakes. He'd been out of the game too long. I think he was stunned at the sort of wages the footballers were earning. There's lots of things about that that were a problem. But also, contracts with suppliers or merchandising agreements were really poor for City. You know, there's something ridiculous, like they were only earning £26,000 a year for merchandise because it had been outsourced. well, I mean, that handicapped the club. That prevented the club from moving forward. So Francis Lee changed a lot of that. He ripped up the plans for the Kippax stand and built a bigger stand, because it would have been, at one point, the bottom tier of that Kippax stand was going to be plastic seats bolted onto the original terracing. Francis Lee ripped all that up and built a better stand. And just as we were finishing that, that's when the sort of negotiation started for the new stadium. And Francis Lee was there at the start of that, really. It had been a long sort of road, and he wasn't the person who signed the agreement to say we'd move. Absolutely not. That came in 1999, but he was there at the start of the discussions. And so, yes, in terms of on the pitch, his time as chairman was an absolute failure, no doubt about that. But as his time for the club, he improved it considerably, and I think the club was doomed without Francis Lee. And with Francis Lee, because he appointed Alan Ball, he wasn't able to save it. It saddens me, that, really, because Francis Lee deserved better. And he tried his best. He was let down.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Gary James paying tribute to the late Francis Lee. We'll look ahead now to the game with Arsenal. And we've kind of focused a lot on whether Rico Lewis will be involved, Dom. There's going to be no Rodri for one last time for what I imagine is, like, you know, injury aside, the rest of the season now. How do you solve it this weekend? Lewis may be an option, maybe not. I don't know.
I think Lewis is an option with someone else in there. I'd be minded to go with the side from Wednesday with Kovacic slotting in for Rodri. I know the different types of players, but and just seeing how well that works. One thing that I think, you know, probably doesn't bode too well is when Rodri got sent off. I think there was people talking that already looking at the Arsenal game of how that might shake out. Now, the first two games of his ban, I think, have whittled down the options in that Calvin Phillips played at Newcastle and was all right, but I think it speaks volumes he then doesn't play at Wolves, so he's out of the equation. Nunes playing at Wolves and getting subbed at half time. You're not going to start with the Emirates now after that, really, are you? Or if you did, you'd have been starting him with Kovacic or someone else or Bernardo in there. But then Rico Lewis plays how he does against Leipzig. And yeah, so Phillips and Nunes have probably played themselves out of contention, which by process of elimination puts Kovacic there. And I'd always be minded to, from a City point of view, I think you want to see Bernardo Silva in central midfield in those games.
But he's been
so good on the right-hand side over the last few months, end of last season, that you probably put him there.
Yeah, but I mean, I was going to come to this though, Adam, because like, as much as Nunes and Phillips haven't been great options, they were, as we were talking about before, in a team that was full of ball carriers instead of a team full of controlling players. If you have Bernardo Silva in the team, if you've got Jack Grealish in the team, if you've got players that can control the tempo, and I mean, I don't suspect he'll start, given he's only just back from injury himself and he hasn't played any minutes whatsoever up until this game. But if you've got somebody in the back line who can pass it more, like John Stones, or somebody who can step into midfield like John Stones, then does that change the dynamic a little bit? And does it give a little bit of an option for those players who maybe have played the way out of contention to play the way back into it a little bit?
It's so true. So I don't think that Pep thought he would have this type of dilemma because of how the Leipzig game went when he was going to be naming his Arsenal team. I think he might have had one eye on it. I think he's definitely going to want to have a more controlled lineup rather than a ball-carrying lineup. And that seems to be the dilemma, like the first dilemma. Second one is, you make a great point there that if Nunes is in a team that's set up to control, so his ball carrying skills aren't really needed, but his ball retention skills and his kind of lending it and getting it back and keeping hold of the ball are used, and he's screened in that way, then do we see a different Nunes than the one who's played himself out of contention because he was quite lackluster and quite light in the midfield at Wolves? So I think you get a different type of player it seems obvious to say you get a different type of player based on the system they're in, but we've not seen that side of them yet because the games have been introduced in. It's been in this new City, ball-carrying City, rather than a controlled City that we've seen. And I think we need the controlling City for Arsenal away. We've been too easy to counter-attack, as we've alluded to in previous conversations on the pod today. And, you know, we've leaked goals. We've not kept a clean sheet away from home since the first game of the season at Burnley in all competitions. So we are susceptible to conceding. So the way you arrest that is by having control of the ball and not trying to break the lines by running through it as we have in previous games, where so far it has been successful until the time it's not, and then it's the worst idea in the world.
Yeah. Dom, there is a counter-argument to that as well, in that look at Arsenal away last season and the season before. City didn't really control the ball in those two games, but they had enough in the tank to get the job done and they won the games.
Yeah, that was with the away game. De Bruyne is massive in that, and obviously that isn't an option they have. I also think in the Arsenal game last year, I don't think it was completely by design they didn't have control. I just think Arsenal played very, very well at their place. I take the point. I mean, I guess one thing I was thinking is Nunes, sort of the way he does carry the ball so well, you're going to have periods of the game where Arsenal will pin City back. Nunes, like, on form and, you know, breaking lines and going forward into their half. That could work, but I don't know. I think you want to go into games like this, operate with as much, you know, not having unknowns in there, really. And, like, while I totally take the point that Phillips and Nunes with more control players around them could look better, but certainly Nunes. I don't know. The thing I'd like to know, if you get inside Guardiola's head, there's absolutely no point asking him at the Friday press conference, he will not answer it, is did he pick Rico Lewis on Wednesday night as part of a rotation, as getting minutes, getting experience playing midfield in Europe, all good things, or did he play him there as a dress rehearsal to go, right, can I do this against Arsenal? And I'd lean towards it being the latter because of what we just said about Nunes and Phillips not really hitting the mark over the last week. It's like, right, I can't do that. Can I do this, though?
No, I'm not sure I agree with that, you know, because I think if that was the case, I don't think he'd play 90 minutes. It's a lot to ask him, isn't it, to play 90 minutes on Wednesday and then 90 minutes on Sunday in two big games like that.
Can I just say, this is probably the most debated team lineup I can remember in recent times, because literally there's so many different moving parts to how we should approach the game. We've now all of a sudden got two ways of playing.
Too many players, if anything, I think.
the squad's massive. No, I think it's really interesting. It's going to be, sorry to cut across you, but I just realised then, I don't remember debating a lineup even ahead of Champions League. Over with Pep, you've almost known how he's approaching games. Now we're questioning, is he, like, you know, two steps ahead by testing things out at Leipzig for Arsenal? And it's actually really, really interesting, because I've got no clue as to what the lineup's going to be, because does he risk Stones? Probably not. So then how do you fix that problem? It's crazy.
He's not even overthought it yet.
Yeah, exactly.
The game's going to be good, but Twitter at 3:30 is going to be...
Oh, my God.
The absolute
inject
place
it.
To be, yeah.
Inject it.
Yeah, clear your diary, lads. Make sure you've got time to be refreshing that phone. Make sure get your battery pack out as well, and make sure you've got charge in your phone. let's look at the rest of the team then as well, because it's not all about who's going to play holding midfield for City. Adam, you mentioned John Stones unlikely to come back in, and I agree with you. I think it's a lot to ask him off the back of an injury, but maybe you need somebody who can pass it in the back four. What about Nathan Ake? He really struggled with Neto on Saturday. Would you be tempted to stick Guardiola in there instead?
So that was one thing, right? I rarely dig Pep out, because obviously he knows a lot more than me and he's the best manager we're ever going to have. But he spent all Friday afternoon in the press conference before the Wolves game highlighting Neto, how he was the danger man, how much damage he can cause, and then leaves Guardiola on the bench. Now, I know Ake's had some recent success with marking Saka out of games in recent times.
Literally everybody he's come up against.
No, exactly. I don't want to do Ake a disservice either. I'd rather have Ake in the centre and have... I just think Guardiola was perfect for that Wolves game and he didn't play him. He's obviously got Leipzig in mind, maybe even had Arsenal if we're playing this 3D chess game that we seem to be suggesting. But I'm not revisionary on this one. I wanted Guardiola in the lineup before Wolves because of the threat that Pep had spent all Friday afternoon talking about, and then he just ignores it on the Saturday. He knows more than me, but that was my thought at the time.
Can I just ask you, Adam, 3D chess, isn't that just chess?
Not if you play it on an Amstrad, or an Abstrad. So yeah,
because 2D chess would be that chess that you get in the newspapers, or like you said, the
that's what I meant.
Yeah,
and 3D chess is more advanced, just like Pep Guardiola.
It's still just normal chess on the board. It's 4D chess, isn't it? The one that'd include like height as well, wouldn't it? It'd be different layers. Yeah. I don't know. I just wondered what dimension you were working in here.
You got me, but I was comparing it to 2D chess rather than.
I see. Yeah.
They've got giant chess outside the library in Central Leeds, like big chess that you can like. It's funny. Sometimes you see like fellas there like having a proper game, but like the pawns are about 2 or 3 foot, and like movies, and then you've got kids just trying to like run off with the horse and stuff. It's a good spectacle.
Yeah. The other selection, Dom, is I think a lot more of an easier choice for Guardiola. Obviously Jack Grealish started against Leipzig. Twitter didn't seem that impressed with his performance, but I thought he was fine. And then Jeremy Doku comes on, gets a goal and an assist, and it kind of highlights what he can offer. I wonder how tempted Guardiola would be to scratch that itch of having Doku on the pitch, because Grealish, by all, like everybody knows what he will bring, and he will give City a lot more control of that game than Doku will. Doku's a very new player, but Doku, unpredictable, isn't he? He could just have that spark.
Yeah, comes on and gets a goal on the assist. I mean, there's not much more you can do from the bench, really. I would be amazed if Grealish doesn't start. If you think of all those City's big performances last year, whether it's the Arsenal games home and away, Madrid, Bayern Munich, Liverpool at home, Grealish played in all of them, and Grealish was prominent in all of them. He's probably not quite up to his best form yet. He's another one who's had an injury, but I mean, I guess you could play them both, but then we don't go with this idea of playing Rico Lewis, and you stick Bernardo and Foden inside with a holder. So you have Doku on the right.
No Alvarez? That's a...
Well, yeah. God, yeah. No Alvarez. That's. I mean...
Squad's too big.
Yeah, yeah. Sell some players. Yeah.
Some of them have got to go, yeah.
Yeah, sell free to Chelsea in January. Yeah, what we were saying before, though, about the... basically just play the Leipzig team, but with Kovacic instead of Rodri. That also doesn't have Alvarez in it.
Yeah.
Drop Ireland? I don't know.
This is mad.
Yeah,
it's the Rugby World Cup. Pick 15.
Fine. Yeah, let's do that. Right. Well, we were so close to adding to the charity bet tally on Wednesday night, and we would have done without Jeremy Doku's stoppage time goal, but we didn't have 3-1. So we stay on £175 raised so far this season for the Man City fans food bank support group. William Hill is giving us 3 £10 correct score singles, and the Arsenal game is the only one to predict this week. So I'm going to kick us off because I've got a rather boring 1-1, which is 11-2 and £55 if I'm right. Adam, what are you having for this one?
I'm going, just because of our inability to keep clean sheets away, I'm going for 2-2.
2-2 draw is 12-1 and £120 if you're right, Dom.
Because of City's inability to keep clean sheets away, I'm going for a 3-1 City win.
3-1 City, yeah, is 20-1 and £200 if you're right. Hey, you never know. Might be right. You never know. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on how to gamble responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. Dom, I am intrigued by your prediction because I think 3-1 is like, I think if you ask most City fans, then most City fans will go, yeah, get out of there with a point and I'm happy. So, like, it feels optimistic.
How many league games in a row have they won against Arsenal now?
It's a lot, yeah, I take the point.
Yeah, so maybe that's got to end at some point. I don't know. Am I allowed to say they won the treble and they're really good, so I think they'll win most games?
That's a valid opinion.
I mean, to be fair... Talking all that absolute wham about the lineup for 15 minutes, I've probably convinced myself they won't win 3-1. But I gave the prediction beforehand. I think I'm just backing the best team in the world to win a football match.
Yeah, exactly that. Every year though, we have somebody on the podcast who predicts a win at Anfield. And I'm just like, lads, it's not happening.
That's mental. Don't do that.
Yeah. Adam, are you in my boat? Like, doesn't matter the performance. Get a point. Get out of there. And
yeah, I think there's plenty of time in the season to make amends if something disastrous happens here. So don't let it, and just control the game and just get out of there with some semblance of a result.
Yeah, well, we'll see how all that goes down on next week's Blue Moon podcast. But for now, that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to my guests for this one, Adam Carter.
Always a pleasure.
And Dom Farrell.
Thanks a lot, lads.
I'll be back after the game with Arsenal, so I'll see you then.
That was the Blue Moon podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Neutrals decide before every game that we've already won it. Mm. They forget that the other team is there and they want to win as well. And so when a goal does get scored against us, I think there is greater weight and significance added to it, which means that even though the quality might not be the same, I think once a goal goes in like that, you just sort of have to say, oh, yeah, fair play.
Can you be quite philosophical when that happens? Because, I mean, like the Graham Dorans one made it, I think, 2-1 at the time, so City was still winning. And Ciso scored, and City had already won the title. The game didn't really matter. It was a dead rubber, and it made it 1-1. But goals like Crouch's and like Townsend's gave the opposition the lead. So how philosophical can you be when such a good goal is scored and City have fallen behind?
You can't in the moment, can you? Because I think in the moment you think, bloody typical that he'd do that against us. Why not wait till next week? But then months go by, we won the title in 2012, we won the title in 2019... we won the title this season as well. So maybe that's the trick. Maybe at some point in 2014, maybe that's the trick. We have to concede great goals at points in the season. Maybe that's the price we have to pay.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.